entered the opera house just as she was singing, "He loves me, he loves me not, he loves me," and sprinkling the falling daisy petals with notes as clear as dew. She sang, of course, "Mamma," and not "He loves me," since an unalterable and unquestioned law of the musical world required that the German text of French operas sung by Swedish artists should be translated into Italian for the clearer understanding of English-speaking audiences. That's a passage about opera from the opening of Edith Wharton's novel, The Age of Innocence. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Year.
Why are so many Americans afraid to go to an opera? What do we miss if we go see Broadway musicals and Hollywood films, but avoid attending operas by Rossini, Verdi, Mozart, and other great operatic composers? Joining us to break down the wall between American audiences and the world's great operas is Fred Plotkin, an internationally recognized classical music aficionado who is performance manager of the Metropolitan Opera. He is the author of many books, including Opera 101, A Complete Guide to Learning and Loving Opera.
And welcome to our little stage here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here in Wisconsin.
What brought this form of entertainment, art, about in the first place?
A bunch of very boring men. They were a group called the Camerata Fiorentina, and they were sitting in 1597 in Florence trying to decide how to bring back the arts of antiquity, singing, drama, dance, spoken word, visual arts, and they put together a series of works called opera. In Italian, work is opera, opera lirica, lyric work, that produced a very boring night at the opera that was a recitation of stories from antiquity, but it had no drama, it had no cohesion. And I believe that with every art form, with every endeavor, it takes a genius or at least an innovator to see things in ways that no one else sees it. And it took a few years before Claudio Monteverdi, who was from northern Italy, decided that the opera lirica could take the ancient arts, but it had to do something new. And what is that? It had to marry words and music, where the text inspired the composer both in the sound of the words and the meaning of the words to create music that expressed the emotions in the stories. And then it had to be acted in a very meaningful way. And that is, in effect, how it began. And it's never stopped since.
Well, the passage I opened with from Edith Wharton, which struck me as kind of funny, the part where it talks about the law of the musical world that required that the German text of French operas sung by Swedish artists translated into Italian for the understanding of English-speaking audiences, it suggests that layer of difficulty that may exist between an American audience and an opera. Can you talk something about why it is that so many Americans fail to have the connection to opera that Europeans do?
Well, I must say, I think that this is slightly old thinking. When I go around the United States and when I go to Europe, I amaze the Americans and I outrage the Europeans by saying that, in my view, the United States is now the world center of opera. And we have more than 210 companies in this country, very vibrant. They produce a vast range of operas from the very common that we know, such as La Bohème and Rigoletto and Tosca and Madame Butterfly, to ones that we've never heard of. Last year, the United States created 14 new opera works. Now, it's not that every new opera will join what we call the standard repertory, but it's very important in any art form to keep moving forward. And we do that here. This is not to say that opera in Europe is dead, but opera in Europe, in my view, and I don't want to take the whole continent as one, is a bit on the critical list. Italians, young Italians, do not go to the opera as much as young Americans do. Young French, young Germans, and young Finns do go a fair amount, and young Austrians too, because their parents still encourage that and teach it, and because in their schools, every child learns to read music. which is something that we have to reintroduce to the United States. Whether we become musicians or not, it doesn't matter. I was in Norway recently, and I was in a church in the far northern point of Norway. And it was Sunday, and I went to the worship, and every person opened their hymnal and sight-read the music. Every person from 4 to 90 could read music and sing to the music. We have to return to that here because it will cultivate our brains no matter what it is we do. And I think once we do that, that will open the door to opera and classical music to more people. It was Duke Ellington who said there are only two kinds of music. There's good music and there's the other kind. And we recognize that when we hear it. So opera always can grow, but nowhere does it grow faster than the United States.
How important is the tune, though? I mean, an accessible tune to somebody who doesn't know anything about opera. They might go into a musical, might go into an opera if there's something that they can whistle on the way home.
Well, most operas have that. And in some operas, it's repeated often enough so it really drums into your head. But most operas do have that. And the way that I would tell someone to go to an opera, number one, it's not a test. You don't pass and fail. You go and you do this for pleasure. You go to discover things about the world and about yourself that opera reflects back to you. This is why one of the reasons we love it. So the tune is there. But if we develop our hearing rather than our just sense of sitting back and whatever washes over us, but if we actually listen to what's going on, we get so much more information. This applies not only to music, but to conversation, to work, to school.
But you, although you say, you know, go to the opera for pleasure, in your book, Opera 101, you definitely give your readers some homework to do before going to an opera, right?
Well, I believe in that because, I don't know, when golfers want to play golf, they don't walk out on the golf course the first day and swing and play 18 holes. They study. They learn. Most things that we do, we learn a bit before we do that. So most books about opera tell the stories of the opera. I don't think I need to do that. What I'd like to do with Opera 101 is to create the skills to go to an opera, so that then you can sit back once you have the skills and not then have to analyze everything. So what I have people do very simply is get a recording, and nowadays people can download recordings, they can borrow them from the library, or if they wish, they can purchase them, and listen to the music once. Just let that music play without analyzing, just hear it. That's how the tunes register. Then read the story. Perhaps read the libretto, which is to say the text, so that you can know exactly what they're saying. When people go to the opera nowadays, we have what are called supertitles, projected titles above the stage. I'm not a fan, because when people start to read the titles, they analyze the story and they ask themselves, why is so-and-so doing this? And that doesn't make sense. And that's not realistic, they say. Now, we live in a country where reality television purports to be realistic, which is just crazy. So realism is about emotion. It's about how quickly and how deeply we identify with something. I don't identify with Britney Spears. I don't identify with the silliness that's presented on TV. Whereas when I go to an opera and people talk about love, sacrifice, war, conflicted devotion to parent, to country, to politics, to self. These are real issues. And opera addresses them not only in the words. Remember, as I said, the words are just the jumping off point for the composer to write the music. And this is not background music like a movie. The story is told in the music. So when we listen to the music, even if we don't understand the words, and even if we don't read, as I don't think we should simply listen and watch what's going on the stage. It's live theater. And then we will connect to what's going on in a much deeper way.
And why do you start with Rigoletto as your first opera? And can you take us into it?
Well, Giuseppe Verdi wrote Rigoletto in 1851. And he was already a great composer, but this was the opera that launched him into the stratosphere as probably one of the two great composers of the 19th century for opera, along with Richard Wagner in Germany. And Rigoletto is not particularly long by opera standards. It's about 2 hours and 50 minutes, including two intermissions. That's the length of movies. It's shorter than football games, so we have to keep it in perspective. And in the opera, you get to take two breaks. And unlike football games, where everything comes to a stop and they have to move the ball and they're advertising and pom-poms, it doesn't stop in opera. It keeps hurtling forth. And the thing I love about Rigoletto, among many things, the music is absolutely listenable, accessible. We know half the music already just from hearing it in the world. And the story is very gripping, very universal, a bit extreme. But, you know, we live in a comfortable place for the most part. But if we look around the world and read the newspapers, such stories can happen. It's the story of a girl named Gilda who is kept in the house by her father, Rigoletto. He's a very loving father. Her mother died, and therefore he doesn't quite know how to manage to take care of her. She's not a bad girl, but she's a very naive girl. And there's a woman there who looks after her. And Rigoletto works in the palace of the Duke of Mantua. And the Duke of Mantua, who's a tenor and therefore very libertine, any girl he sees, he likes. And because he's the Duke, he can have his way with her. So the Duke, although he's married, is out and about courting and chasing women, often the wives and daughters of courtiers, of enemies, and so forth. And so many people are angry at the Duke, needless to say. Rigoletto is the jester in the court. He has a hunchback, and therefore he's viewed as different, as deformed. And we could take that metaphor of being different and being an outcast for your difference. And frankly, most people in America and the world could find something in that to identify with. Most teenage girls have known what it's like to fantasize about boys and not have access. When Gilda's allowed out once a week to go to church, she goes to church and sees this dashing young man who says he's a student. He's actually the Duke of Mantua. So they fall in love. Gilda is abducted by the courtiers, and then the Duke, who was not involved in the abduction, has his way with her. Now, when we see her again, she's very dazed and confused, as one might expect. But here's where interpretation can come in. She might have actually liked it. She may not have liked it. And the way that it's played by the singer in question directs the opera one way or another. So if we see Rigoletto the opera once, it doesn't mean we've seen it. We've seen one performance, one concept of it. And finally, Rigoletto is so angry that his daughter has been abducted and then violated that he plots to kill the Duke, which is high treason. And he arranges with an assassin to do it. The Duke is with a prostitute who happens to be the sister of the assassin. And the prostitute says, oh, he's so cute. Don't kill him. Kill someone else. Kill anyone who comes by. Gilda naively decides, I'm going to save him because he loves me. I know he loves me. She arrives at the house by the river. She is stabbed to death by the assassin. Rigoletto comes to collect the sack where supposedly the Duke would be in it. He opens the sack and finds his daughter, who is not yet dead, because in opera, if she were dead, then they couldn't sing a duet. So they sing a duet. She dies, and Rigoletto cries to the heavens, ah, la maledizione, oh, the curse. And we could say, well, curses don't exist, and this is implausible, and a girl would know better. And all I want to do is point anyone to the news and read the daily papers and the metro sections of your papers. This happens in versions every day, all the time. And it's as real as life. And the music is so gripping and the narrative so arresting and the solo part so incredibly well drawn that no one I have ever known has come out of Rigoletto not being absolutely transformed into opera. This is just the beginning of talking about Rigoletto, which is just the first opera in Opera 101. I only chose to teach 11 operas rather than do books with 100 or 200 stories, because by the end of the book, the reader and the listener will have the skills to see any opera, and that's really the point.
Well, as you were telling the story of Rigoletto, I was picturing it because I've seen a production fairly recently, and the costumes and the staging and the lighting and all that, that plays a role too, which is hard to do on radio. But can you set up a sample of the music from Rigoletto that we might listen to?
Well, I would like us to listen to Caro Nome. Caro Nome means dear name. Now, it sounds like a silly title, but when Gilda has come home from church and the young man she's interested gets into her house and says hello to her and woos her and says, I'll see you again, and she says, well, tell me, what is your name? And he says, Gualtier Maldet, sono studente. Now, that's a French name, and this is said in Mantua in Italy. And then he says in Italian, I'm a student. And any infatuated girl would say, ah, oh, Gualtier Maldet, what a name, what a beautiful name. So the aria, which is gorgeous, is not so much about saying his name and not about the words that she sings, but if we listen to the music, we can hear an adolescent girl in the blush of first love suddenly realizing her hormones, her emotions all kicking in. And the music is about that, not about the words.
Certainly a showstopper.
She did stop the show. Now, what's interesting is that you heard little bits of chorus at the end. This was from a live performance. And what the chorus was about to do, these were the courtiers were coming to abduct Gilda. So after this gorgeous ethereal music, suddenly everything gets very harsh and dramatic again as they take her away from her house. And Rigoletto, who has been blindfolded, he thinks it's part of a game, suddenly finds that his door is open, his daughter is gone, and he cries, "Oh, la maledizione," and that's when he goes to look for the assassin. By the way, that was Renata Scotto, a very young Renata Scotto at a time when she still sang lighter music. She was about 32 years old then. She then went into heavier repertory, which means more dramatic, because her voice had more heft to it than most of the girls who sing Gilda. But it was a very valid, good performance, and great for live performance where there are no knobs and studio controls to make little corrections.
We're going to explore more in the world of opera when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Radio Waves is Wisconsin Public Radio's e-newsletter. Sign up and you'll receive a monthly email with what's happening at WPR. A subscription to Radio Waves is free, and getting it is simple. Just go to WPR.org.
Here we arrive at an essential secret that opera lovers know and those on the outside never suspect. The chief undercurrent in most operas is raw sex. Those who poo-poo opera think of it as a collection of loud, fat people with too much makeup who overact in front of an audience of overfed, sleepy people. But this is a cliche used by people who don't know what's going on. We who go to the opera often respond viscerally to the actions depicted on stage, many of which are far more erotic than a cheap film, a pulpy novel, or the latest rock video. Perhaps because in opera these sensations are deepened by glorious music, sung in a foreign language, and are not as frankly smutty as some popular entertainment, we do not think of it as something that the self-appointed guardians of morals in our society would target. A night at the opera is often thought of as participation in an elitist event that is sanctioned by the social and moral establishment. But don't forget how the censors were outraged by the first performances of Rigoletto, La Traviata, and many other operas.
That's Fred Plotkin reading from his book Opera 101, A Complete Guide to Learning and Loving Opera. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Fred Plotkin, an alumnus of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, here as an artist in residence. I love that passage you wrote about opera, how we think of it as such a refined, elitist activity, something that people would approve of, when you're saying, in fact, it's just raw sex.
I had to mop my brow writing it and then now reading it. The truth is that sex is human. It's wonderful also when done with the right people. And this happens on stage, not that they depict sex, although that occasionally happens.
More and more of late.
But the point is, it is the undercurrent of our lives. I defy anyone of any age, shape, size, sexual preference, anything, to tell me that when he or she walks down a street and there's someone or something attractive, they make note of it. Their heart races a bit. Their pupils dilate. We have physical reactions that just happen, and we can't, and I don't think we should control them. We should not offend or harm anyone. But on the other hand, if we experience a sensation, we should acknowledge it and enjoy it, even if it's not acted upon. It's part of what we are and what makes us alive.
And it's a great way to get a plot going, too, whether it's a matter of a consensual romantic relationship or some kind of a power relationship, as we saw in Rigoletto.
Absolutely. Well, these exist throughout opera. I'm asked all the time, too often, what's your favorite opera? And I do have a long list. And if I always say, if I had to only have one, it would be Verdi's Don Carlo. Because Verdi's Don Carlo has everything. It has politics in the extreme. It has issues of love, devotion to parents, to oneself, to nationhood, to revolution, to free thought. But it also has tons of plain raw sex. And for example, there is Carlo, a prince, and this is based kind of on true characters, who is the son of King Philip II of Spain. Carlo has been promised to a woman named Elizabeth. And it's love at first sight both ways. She is a princess in France. But then word arrives that Elizabeth is to marry Carlo's father, Philip. And therefore, the whole plot goes awry. Carlo is beseeched by his friend Rodrigo to forget about Elizabeth, forget about his father, and fight for the freedom of Flanders. Now, the character of Rodrigo, who is a wonderful, noble, intelligent, brave character, very likely was homosexual. I don't say gay because that's a different construct than homosexual in this context, and probably loved Carlo more than Carlo loved him back in that way. But they loved each other as true friends, and there was great friendship music in the opera. But Carlo cannot quite let go of the idea of Elizabeth. Then there's the Princess Eboli, who is the mistress of the father, of the king, but who's interested in becoming the wife of Carlo.
Meanwhile,
and actually much of this is true. And one of the great scenes in all of opera is Act 4, Scene 1, in which we begin with Philip's singing alone, singing Ella Jemima Mo about Elizabeth, she never loved me. Then the Grand Inquisitor comes in and tells Philip that he has to kill his own son for the sake of Spain. And Philip decides to do that. Then Rodrigo comes in and pleads for Carlo's cause. Then Elizabeth comes in, is slapped by the king. And then Eboli comes in, one after the next, and each one picking up on the events of the others. She discovers that Carlo is about to be put to death. She loves Carlo. She reveals to Elizabeth all the bad things she's been doing and then sings one of the great show-stopping arias in all of opera, O Don Fatale, O Fatal Gift That I've Been Given of My Beauty, that this is the way people react with me and deal with me. Were I not so beautiful, perhaps I would have had a different life. And I'd love to hear it now. O Don Fatale,
Beauty of the music aside, and there was plenty of it there in Don Carlo with Shirley Verrett. Sometimes we, at least I, almost get distracted by the sheer athleticism of the performer.
Well, while this is going on, she is – the character has an eye patch in most performances, and this is actually a challenge darting about the stage when one eye is covered. And She takes documents, throws them into the fire. She runs over and reads another document that finds that Carlo is condemned. And some performers of the role of Eboli, such as Tatiana Troyanos, used to lift up the eye patch and yank it off in fury so that we would see that she was not the perfect beauty. And it was her moment of expression that even I, with all of my wiles and all of my beauty, am imperfect. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly dramatic. And I think if you listen to the orchestra part in that aria, you hear this increasingly fervent heartbeat. And throughout the aria, there's a heartbeat going on. It's mostly in the cellos and also in the timpani and in the drums. And at the end, there's this powerful drum roll as she sails off to save Carlo. Very dramatic and very athletic.
We've heard a couple of sopranos by this point, but I did notice that the foreword to your book, Opera 101, is by Placido Domingo, and who writes, by the way, "One cannot help falling in love with opera all over again reading this book." Nice way to begin. But what about some of the male superstars that we would hear? And why is it, by the way, that the tenors tend to be, you know, less villainous than the basses? Who decided that the lower the voice, the more villainous the character?
In most cases, the heroine is a soprano. And if you have two high voices, tenor and soprano, it has a different kind of blend than if you were to have a lower voice. Then it might be father and daughter, such as in Rigoletto, or a very low voice, it might be someone villainous and someone innocent. That is an operatic construct. It doesn't always work that way. Carmen, for example, is a mezzo-soprano, and there are many sexy and fascinating mezzos. Eboli is a mezzo-soprano, whom we just heard.
Or these be perhaps the more experienced?
Yes, they're women who've been around the block, paved the block, actually. But they're interesting. Think of that in life.
Oh, depth of
women
character.
Women of experience are women, and I mean that in every sense, are interesting women. Who have things to tell, have stories to tell. I find that with old people. I have a tendency, I'm 51, to gravitate to very old people because I like to ask them questions about what they know. And in the same thing in opera, the deeper voices are often the voices of wisdom, not just the voices of malice.
Or authority in the case of your baritones in particular.
Yeah. But the tenors tend to be either noble or stupid as characters. But they're the lovers in most cases. There are exceptions.
And the most loved.
And the most loved. And then they usually die. And Domingo is a phenomenon because he has now sung 125 different roles in his career, which is so far more than anyone else that we may as well just seal that page in the Guinness Book. And he does them beautifully, honorably, with great interpretation. It's not always that you see Placido Domingo on the stage. You will see Cavaradossi from Tosca. You will see Otello. You will see Siegmund from Wagner's Die Walküre. He creates thorough characters, and that's part of his fascination. I was very flattered that he agreed to write the foreword to my book.
Do you have a recording of him singing a particular aria that we could hear?
I have a recording of Mr. Domingo. Well, perhaps we can hear him in Don Carlo as well, either solo or perhaps in his what we call the love duet with Rodrigo. It's not a love duet. It's a friendship duet, but it's gorgeous. And he sings it here with Cheryl Milnes, wonderful American baritone.
Oh, God.
Cheryl Milnes and Placido Domingo with one of those great friendship duets. That one came from Verdi's Don Carlos.
My response whenever I hear things like this, and I've heard this duet hundreds of times, is always, what's not to love? You know, if people create for themselves the notion of, oh, I can't go to the opera, and they come up with reasons, that's their own loss. But really, what's not to love? I only answered a personal ad once in my life, and it was a woman I liked for many, many reasons. And we went out for lunch, and I liked her. And then I said, would you like to get together again? She said, I would. I said, may I invite you to an opera next week? She said, I hate opera. And I said, how many operas have you been to that you hated? I went to La Boheme when I was 11. I hated it. I hate opera. Now, what was interesting, this woman was in publishing. And I said, do you hate old books because you read one book you don't like?
No. When you were 11.
When you were 11? No, but I hate opera. That was the end of our relationship. But the point is that people can construct whatever reason they want to not go. But the reasons to go are so many, for the enlightenment, for the pleasure, for the ability to pause in a place for 3 hours without intrusions of the outside world, to really go on this little journey of music and story. And also, frankly, Nowadays, everything is technological. We hear things on microphones. We hear things in iPods. And opera is natural sound, both in the orchestra and from the singers. And to hear a person stand on stage and pour out beautiful sound for hours is a phenomenal human feat.
Well, and I would have to say also that being the here and now and being the most complex and difficult forms of music, there's that excitement of not knowing from one second to the next how it's going to come out.
Exactly. It's live theater, apart from anything else. If you have the elephant rampage across the stage in Aida, that you cannot coach the elephant.
And for better or worse. There is that, that undercurrent of, gosh, will, the ship fall apart in Flying Dutchman? But much more on the positive side is, which note is she going to go for at the end of this aria?
That, or when you go to the opera expecting to hear Singer A and she cancels because she has the flu, and you're disappointed because she's a big star, and then Singer B comes on, you say, who is that?
And you find out.
Many years ago, I went to hear Teresa Stratus and John Vickers in Otello at the Met, February 9th, 1974. And Stratus was sick, and a young unknown woman was brought on to replace her, named Kiri Takanawa.
I knew you were going to say that.
In her Met debut. And it was phenomenal. And although I loved and loved Teresa Stratus, to hear Kiri Takanawa in her Met debut was not bad.
Well, back to this woman that you went out with once and then not again because she didn't want to go to an opera. I mean, to try to understand the resistance or whatever. If I were to go to attend Fiddler on the Roof, I would simply listen to the singers singing the words in English, and the singing would not be covered with so much vibrato. I mean, one of the stereotypes about opera is that when you're listening to a singer, first of all, it's in a language that often you do need the supertitles, which you said you aren't in favor of, but sometimes we don't know what the words are otherwise. And the vibrato is often very, very noticeable compared to if you just went to a show and heard somebody singing to you more in a accessible
in a direct
style.
Voice.
Yes.
Vibrato is not necessarily a bad thing if the singer is the master of the vibrato and not the other way around. So that if it's being used for expressive purposes, it's very effective. For example, Shirley Verrett in O Don Fatale used some very good vibrato. But we shouldn't think of that as the negative part. In all things in life, if people look for the negative, they're sure to find it. I should have known, by the way, with that woman that when she ordered liver as her main course, that I don't know how far we would have gone.
Well, but I was thinking of Gilbert and Sullivan, too, because Gilbert and Sullivan do tackle some of the the comic parts of opera, the fact that you can sing while you're dying or sing about how you're going to go but never actually leave the stage.
True. Well, to really appreciate that aspect of Gilbert and Sullivan, then you have to know the background of opera, yet another reason to go to the opera. By the way, one of my favorite composers is Donizetti. And if you listen to Gilbert and Sullivan, you can obviously tell they love Donizetti because there's so much Donizetti light or reinterpreted in Gilbert and Sullivan's terrific.
Well, in your Opera 101 book, besides the Rigoletto that you say is a good place to start, you go ahead then and give us 10 more operas to attend that each represent something different. Can you just tell us what those are?
Well, if not to attend, at the very least to get recordings to listen and learn, and if you can attend them, obviously go. Puccini's Tosca. So we can learn about opera as drama, the theatrical component of opera. Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, which is opera expressing drama through music. They may not move around as much, and it may not be as literal as Tosca, but it's highly dramatic. Rossini's The Barber of Seville, which is comedy. And comedy is not easy to play anywhere, but certainly in an opera stage. But Rossini, in his music, not just in the words, has comedy. And to successfully like Rossini, you have to hear the comedic part of his music. Then Mozart's Don Giovanni, one of the great operas of all time, which combines the drama of Rigoletto and Tosca, the fantastic musical drama of Lucia, and the comedy of Barber. So people go to Don Giovanni as their first opera, won't get it. But if you've prepared for it, then you do. Then Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffman, which has comedy, drama, and refers all the time to Don Giovanni, so it's a good link from one to the next. Then Tchaikovsky's gorgeous Eugene Onegin in Russian. So we've gone from Italian to French to Russian. And it, to me, is the most romantic of all operas, much more than La Boheme. And we really discover all aspects of love in hearing Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin. Then Verdi's Don Carlo, which we've listened to, which is grand opera in Italian, though it was also originally done in French. And to me, is the summit of all operas, and I love it. Then Wagner's Tannhäuser, also on my very short list of favorite operas. Talk about sex. The opera, the curtain rises and there's an orgy going on stage.
Venusberg.
And I've seen productions where everybody is absolutely naked, not always in a flattering way. But the music is so intensely erotic. Wagner was the most erotic of all composers. Fantastic, difficult man, but his music is glorious. His operas are all about moral conundrum, and you watch, you listen, you learn, and 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours go by. You don't feel it. There are shorter operas I feel in my backside a lot more than Wagner's Gotterdammerung or the relatively short at 4 hours Tannhäuser. Then Wagner's Die Walküre, we know the Ride of the Valkyries, is part of the famous Ring cycle, the greatest story ever told. And then we end with Richard Strauss's Elektra. The music is somewhat difficult, dissonant, atonal, and it opens the door to that kind of sound. Phenomenally dramatic, and it was also one of the great psychological operas of all time. It was written in Vienna when Freud was practicing in Vienna. And it's a very modern work, and it opens the door to our modern world. And once you've studied those 11 operas, you can see anything.
And unfortunately, we must bring the curtain down on this particular production of University of the Air. But Fred Plotkin, I hope you'll come out and take a bow, at least one or two curtain calls in response to our applause. And you'll have to come back and enlighten us in greater depth about the other 9 or 10 operas on your list sometime.
It'll be a pleasure. Thank you both.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for our next hour of University of the Air. Thank you.